Hi, it's Mike Collins. Before we get to the show, I want to let you know it's WFAE's fall membership campaign. Now, don't worry, you'll hear the podcast without fundraising breaks, but I do want to encourage you to become a financial supporter of Charlotte Talks right now. $8.50 a month will help pay for the server space for us to host this podcast. It also gets you a Charlotte Talks coffee mug. So give at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. Thank you. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. What art can tell us about our relationship with technology and nature? That's later in the program. First, one controversial piece of advice from experts on our role in saving the planet from climate change. They say we must eat less meat. Meat production is a contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, and if we really care about getting a handle on slowing the course of our warming planet, we must reduce our meat consumption, especially beef. Now, you may be skeptical about both the connection and Americans' ability to change their diets that drastically, but perhaps a conversation with our guests today may change your mind. Brian Kateman is co-founder and president of the Reducitarian Foundation. It's a nonprofit dedicated to reducing consumption of meat, eggs, and dairy. He's also the editor of the Reducitarian Cookbook and the Reducitarian Solution, and he joins us via Skype. Good morning. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Nice to have you here. And Tim Searchinger is with us by phone. He is a research scholar at Princeton University and a senior fellow at the World Resources Institute, where he is lead author of their report, Creating a Sustainable Food Future. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Brian, let me start with you because I'm not sure many of our listeners are familiar with the term or even the movement, the reducitarian movement. When did it start? How would you define it?
Well, a reducitarian is anyone who is consciously cutting back on the amount of animal products that they consume, regardless of the degree or the motivation for doing so. You know, I grew up in Staten Island, New York. It's not known to be a particularly progressive place in terms of New York City. I didn't know any vegans or vegetarians, not a lot of swanky plant-based eateries around. So the idea of sort of going vegan or vegetarian would certainly have been a foreign one to me. But I started to care a lot about the environment in college. I was that kid on campus who told people to recycle, to compost, to ride their bike or walk to work instead of drive. And when I made the connection between food and many of the issues that I cared about, like climate change, biodiversity loss, and deforestation, I realized there was a need to make some changes to my diet. And the idea of a kind of all or nothing premise was not one that resonated with me. But there
So being a reducitarian is more than being vegan or a vegetarian, because vegans and vegetarians are off meat, period, done with it. You're saying you can help the planet by reducing your consumption, which means you don't have to give it up at every single opportunity. Is that right?
That's partially right. The way I think about it is that vegans and vegetarians are reducitarians. They are people who have significantly cut back on the amount of animal products they've consumed. In fact, so significantly that they eat none at all. But the idea that that's the only way to help the planet is one that I don't believe. I think there are opportunities to simply cut back, whether that be 10%, 20%, 50%, 90%, so on.
You've admitted that getting people to budge on changing their consumption habits is a bit of a slog for some. Some people are highly motivated, others not so much. So how difficult is it to convert people who don't have this concern for Mother Nature, for the Earth?
It's very difficult. I mean, I think of my father, who's like the typical American, who eats well over 200 pounds of meat a year and doesn't even believe in climate change, doesn't consider it to be a threat. But, you know, my father does think that he needs to lose a few pounds. He does think that diabetes is happening to him. He does think that heart disease runs in his family. So sometimes I find it useful to pull on other motivations, even if one's primary motivation is concern for the climate crisis, using other kinds of messaging to help persuade people that might not be concerned about the same things as they are can be quite useful. But it is definitely a challenge to change people's attitudes and behaviors. But in order to secure a more sustainable planet, we're going to have to change our relationship with the way we eat food, specifically factory farmed meat.
So to be successful and to be a successful reducitarian, you don't have to completely give up red meat or poultry or seafood or dairy or eggs. But all of that is on the list of things you'd like people to give up. And you don't necessarily want people to quit cold turkey. You want them to do it gradually. But how fast is fast enough given what we're facing?
It's a great point. You know, when I started doing this work about 5 years ago, I did feel that cutting back, you know, gradually, you know, was going to be the way to go. And I still do, because we know change is hard and we know people are more likely to stick to dietary change if they do it gradually rather than going cold turkey. But I admit, I do feel the pressure. I mean, I don't know how much time we have before we're seeing irreversible change in terms of the issues that we care about. We know that climate change is affecting diverse populations right now. So, you know, if a person listening is inspired to make some changes within their own life, significantly cutting back on the amount of animal products that they consume and swapping in plant-based foods instead is certainly going to a long way in terms of advancing our environmental goals, and the sooner the better.
That's Brian Kateman. Timothy, or Tim Searchinger, is also with us. He's with Princeton University, the lead author of a report called Creating a Sustainable Food Future. And Tim, a lot of people, I think, are aware now of how raising cattle in the numbers that we must to support our diets, the ones that we've become accustomed to, does harm the planet. And we know that cows produce methane gas, which is a contributor to global warming. But that is not the only impact, is it?
Yeah, the biggest impact really is simply the amount of land that is needed to produce beef above all, but animal products in general. And that's because it's very inefficient. So globally, it takes about 50 calories of feed to 100 calories of feed to make 1 calorie of beef. Mm-hmm. And that means you need a lot of land. And some people think, well, it doesn't really matter because most of the land we devote to beef production is grazing land, and there are native grazing lands. But we long ago used up pretty much all the native grazing lands. And about a third of the global land devoted to beef production was historically forest. And we're still clearing forest in the Amazon and elsewhere to produce more beef. And that, when you clear forest, you lose the carbon. Half of of all plant material is carbon. And so you put that carbon material into the atmosphere. And that turns out to be the dominant number. That really is huge. And when you factor that in, you can argue that our diets produce almost as much greenhouse gas emissions as our energy consumption, at least over a 30-year period. Mm. Which also means, and beef is about half of the greenhouse gas emissions in our diet, even though it only provides about 3% of the calories.
You say to maintain our current production methods and feed a growing world, we would have to convert most of the world's remaining forest to agricultural purposes and would produce almost twice the emissions allowable from all human activities. That's pretty alarming. And when you add to that, when you have to raise grains to feed the cattle, in such a large proportion to what the cattle does to feed us in terms of caloric provisions of providing caloric calories to us, you need water as well. And in a hot world, water is going to become a scarcer commodity, right?
Yes, so all of the above. Now, the number that you gave is if we tried to produce all of the food that we need in 2050 or likely to need in 2050 with today's farms. So basically, we would clear almost all the remaining forests, and the greenhouse gas emissions that alone would cause would be more or less double the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are acceptable. So the good news is we increase our yields, and one of the things we need to do is also increase the efficiency of beef production. So even if the average American were to cut his or her consumption of beef by about 50% by 2050. Because so many people in the world today eat so little beef and so little meat, we will still have to produce some more beef. And that means we also have to increase the productivity and the efficiency of doing that, which above all globally means increasing the efficiency of grazing production. We need all of the above strategy. You know, right now only about 25% of the world's population eats significant amounts of beef. And as the rest of the world gets even just a little bit richer, it will want to eat a little bit. And in order to make room for all of that while solving climate change, the average American has to eat about 1.5 hamburgers per week instead of 3. That's really the key. And that's doable. The average American today eats a third as much beef as he or she did in the 1960s.
So we're already cutting back. So cutting back from 3 hamburgers a week to 1.5 doesn't seem like an undoable unreasonable amount of cutback. That's Tim Serschinger with Princeton University. He's here along with Brian Kateman. We're going to come back and talk more. He's with the Reducetarian Foundation. We're going to come back and talk more about this and what we need to do to be sustainable with our food production and our food diet habits in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sustainability in the food world and the reduction of our consumption of beef and poultry and eggs and seafood and more with Brian Kateman. He's the co-founder and the president of the Reducetarian Foundation and the editor of the Reducetarian Cookbook and the Reducetarian Solution. This is more than being vegan or vegetarian, and it's also not an all or nothing proposition. You can wean yourself away from and never completely walk away from beef and meat consumption if you are a reducetarian. Also with us is Tim Serschinger, who is a research scholar at Princeton University and the lead author of Creating a Sustainable Food Future as part of the World Resources Institute, at which he is a fellow. In the interest of science, gentlemen, and because of this program, 2 days ago, I had my first Impossible Whopper from Burger King. Burger King has put this on the menu, and it is a no-beef patty. It's exactly like a Whopper, except that the patty is vegetarian. And if I hadn't known that I was eating a no-beef Whopper, I don't think I would have known. It tasted good. The consistency was just about what a beef patty would be like. But it occurred to me as I was eating this that I'm still eating something. I'm eating vegetable products. And even though it tasted like beef, it still takes land. It takes water. It takes resources to grow the vegetables in that patty. How does that impact the planet? Tim.
The answer is it's a fraction of the land and a fraction of all of the other inputs that you need to produce beef, and the reason is mostly just efficiency. I mean, as I said before, you need 50 times as much feed a minimum to produce 1 calorie of beef, and when you're eating plant products, and when you're eating plant products, you're just eating the plant products directly. So that means you need much, much less land and less fertilizer and less everything else.
Now, Burger King is not the only company that's offering these meatless hamburgers. And they say at Burger King that the Impossible Whopper has the same amount of protein as the regular Whopper, but with 15% less fat and 90% less cholesterol. So this is not only good for the planet, it's good for us. Is that the selling factor, Brian? Is that what you think people will latch on to if you have any hope of causing more of us to become reducetarians?
I do think that's an important point. You know, most people don't choose food based on environmental issues or ethics or even their own health. They're choosing food based on price, on taste, and convenience, and to some extent, social norms, what other people are eating around them. But when the proposition is that you can enjoy the same flavor and taste experience that you love, and it happens to be better for your health, it happens to be better for the planet, that's going to be a major selling point for folks. And that's why most people who are eating the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger and so on are not vegan or vegetarian. These are simply people who are excited to incorporate more plant-based foods into their diet for many of the reasons that Tim mentioned.
So I think I understand why you are advocating for us to eat less seafood, because the fish in the ocean are imperiled by overfishing. But what about poultry? You want us to reduce our consumption of poultry. You want us to reduce our consumption of eggs. Why?
Well, you know, these are all animals, right? Cows, chickens, pigs. It requires resources in order to grow them. I mean, for example, with chickens, it requires about 9 calories in to get 1 calorie out. It still requires a lot of land. It requires a lot of water to grow the feed. And of course, you know, just on another point here, chickens are also beings. And in factory farms, you know, we're raising them at unprecedented rates with incredibly cruel conditions. And so, you know, for all of these reasons, that's why we really advocate that people not only cut back on red meat, but also chicken and seafood, and really think about incorporating more plant-based foods into their diet on the whole.
So I'm going to ask you about substitutes for poultry. And I know we have egg beaters, which I think are no egg eggs. And I know we have tofurkey, which is tofu turkey. What other options are there? And are there restaurants offering substitutes for poultry like they're offering substitutes for beef?
There are so many options now on the market. It's really just incredible. I mean, you have KFC in the UK testing corn. They called it the Impossible Burger. Corn is a longstanding product on the market. We have Beyond Burger teaming up with KFC in Atlanta, Georgia, actually. They were testing Beyond chicken. And so, I think that these products are already on the in the market in grocery stores. But I think we're going to see the next wave is going to be seeing these plant-based chicken products in major fast food.
Have you tasted these products? As I mentioned, I tasted the Impossible Whopper, ate the whole thing. I would go and buy another one because I like the taste and I like the feel of it, and it was like eating a regular Whopper, but it was healthier. So have you tasted these poultry and egg substitute products? Are they as good as the Impossible Whopper?
I have, and they are, and they're getting better each and every year. I mean, I'll tell you, a couple mornings during the week, I have just egg. It's currently my favorite plant-based egg product on the market. It cooks up just like conventional eggs. It's really delicious. It's a lot healthier for you. You know, I think the best way forward is to be a little skeptical, but try the products, because I think people are going to be really surprised. It's not like it was 20 years ago. Things have really changed due to really, really innovative science and food technology.
I'm embarrassed to tell you.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Timothy. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, I think the big issue is that over the next few years, these are going to be unfolding. And pretty soon, they're going to be cheaper than animal products. Right now, they're a little bit more expensive, and some of that is because they're still learning how to make them more efficiently. And some of that is they don't want to actually sell it as a cheap product. But the reality is that it's just inherently more efficient to produce these things. So I think in the next few years, it's going to be the case that at least for kind of highly processed foods, or minced food, right? When you're eating hamburger, when you're throwing something in a stew, when you're eating something in a taco, whatever, the alternatives are going to become almost indistinguishable, and they should be cheaper. And at that point, I think we begin to have a real fundamental change in culture.
Yeah, we were surprised to learn that most of the people who are trying these products or gravitating toward these alternatives are actually carnivores, people who eat meat, who maybe want to change their diet because their doctor has said they have too much cholesterol or something, and so they're going to these alternative products that taste pretty much like the original product. People who are vegetarians are turned off because they don't like the flavor of those products anymore because they've given up animal products. So do you think these products are really just going to capture and help carnivores with the transition?
Yeah, I mean, the key thing to remember is you don't necessarily have to have a replacement for a great T-bone steak or a wonderful pork loin. What most of our animal products are eaten in some kind of a highly altered form, right? Like a hamburger, which is dense, or you know, cheese and your frozen pizza. And so it's those things that I think are the easiest to substitute for. And my feeling is that when people just realize that there's no particular reason to eat an animal product, they can do just as well with something else, that then the big switches will occur. And it's kind of the last year has been a sea change with the new availability of products.
So we've been talking this hour fundamentally about the impact of beef production, meat production, animal production for food on the planet, and how it requires so many of our natural resources to produce so little calories. It's highly inefficient. And that's also leading to climate change, because they have to clear a lot of forest land to make it into fields so they can grow the feed for the animals. But we have a growing population as well. So this is we need to talk about the future. Your report, Tim, points out that the population of the world is projected to grow from 7 billion in 2010 to 9.8 billion in 2050, and that will require an increase in food production of 50% and a demand for animal-based foods by nearly 70%. If this goes unchecked, what is the impact on the planet to that kind of growth?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you, as I said, there are two ways of thinking about it. Right now, agriculture and associated deforestation contribute about 25% of all the greenhouse gas emissions in the world. If we tried to just go on business as usual with today's farms, it would be overwhelming greenhouse gas emissions and loss of forest. Even if we maintain our historical rate of yield growth so we can produce more food in the same land, agriculture alone would still contribute 70% of the allowable emissions from all human sources by 2050, even though it would only be 2% of GDP. So that doesn't leave any room for really anything else. So you need to make changes. And one of them is changes in the production systems, and they have to become more natural resource efficient. In the U.S., we have to push innovative technology. But one thing we have to do is hold down consumption where we can. And what the average American doesn't realize probably is how few animal products most people in the world eat. So even in 2050, we're predicting that 6 billion people on the planet, 60% of the population, will still eat around a half or less of the animal products of the average American. Mm. And so we're going to get growth both from population and from the fact that if people are not horribly poor, they'll eat at least a little bit more meat and milk, and they deserve to. So one of the real reason we have to hold down our consumption is to make at least a little bit of space so that billions of people in the world can eat just a little. And so that's really the key here. And so in the way of holding down consumption, our big things for the U.S. are trying to reduce beef consumption by half to 1.5 hamburgers a week, roughly equivalent. Reducing food loss and waste, and then another big thing is not producing biofuels. Biofuels take fantastic quantities of resources. They are less than 1% of the efficiency of solar cells in converting the energy of the sun into usable energy. And to produce 2% of the world's energy from biofuels in 2050 would require an amount of crops equal to 30% of all the crops we produce today. So that would take this kind of, just to produce 2% of the energy, that would take this 50% gap and turn it into an 80% gap.
So we need to reduce that. But on top of that, are you confident that we can grow? And if we move away from meat and toward grain and other plant products for food, are you confident that you can feed nearly 10 billion people in a world where the climate is changing so drastically, where we have incredible droughts now and incredible amounts of rain that destroy crops that are growing because they're overcome by the water? Are you concerned at all that that will impact our ability to do this?
Well, yes. I mean, the good news is farmers are remarkably, and farming is remarkably innovative in terms of producing more food. The bad news, even with that innovation, we've cleared an area equal to 5/8 of the continental U.S. of forest just in the last 50 years, and we literally can't afford to clear another acre if we want to solve climate change. So that means we have to farm smarter, and that means we have to moderate our consumption. It's basically that. And the real risk, we can feed ourselves, but the problem is, can we feed ourselves without chopping down the Amazon? That's really kind of the key issue. And the real risk also is that if we have any shortage, it's the world's poor that really suffer. They're the ones that are outcompeted for food when prices get high.
So, Brian Kateman, I have about a minute left here in this segment, but you talk about something that might be considered both controversial and creepy, because you're not saying that we should all just walk away from meat, just reduce our consumption of it, and to help us eat meat, you're suggesting, or people have suggested, that we create animal meat without the use of animals. How do you do that? Has it been done? What would producing these products to scale require?
Well, I understand the intuition that it's creepy, but it's really not creepy at all. What's really creepy is the way we currently raise animals for food in factory farms. And anyone who wants to see the nightmare that it is can look up videos and check it out. The much more beautiful version is being able to have these exact products that we love, nature identical, chemically, biologically, in all its forms, but do so without the use of the animal. And the way that we can do that is by taking a cell of an animal and essentially, like the cell grows in the muscle of an animal, growing it outside of the muscle. In what are called cultivators. You can imagine these sort of, they look like breweries, beer breweries. And over time, the result is that you actually have real meat, nature-identical meat. Now, there are companies that are currently doing this. They've been tested by reporters and some lucky members of the public. It's going to be a couple of years before the price gets knocked down so that it becomes affordable. But cell-based meat is an exciting alternative and one we should be rooting for, in my opinion.
Brian Kateman is co-founder and president of the Reducetarian Foundation. Tim Searchinger is a research scholar at Princeton University with the World Resources Institute, where he's a senior fellow there and the lead author of Creating a Sustainable Food Future, something to chew on this morning. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.